Let's call this meeting of Senate Resources to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:31 p.m. on Friday, April 23rd, 2021. And let the record also reflect that we have a quorum present today. Our Vice Chair Machicki, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Rivak. Like to represent Representative Story, or I'm sorry, acknowledge Representative Story here today to present our bill. Staffing our committee today, our LIO moderator, Nate Williams, and we have Christopher Dickrell online from Records. And I'd just like to take a moment real quick to say that every committee I try to acknowledge and appreciate the wonderful work that our staff does. And today we have our committee aide, Betty Tangeman, who is also here on her birthday. And so as most staff in this building, Betty has worked many nights and weekends in making sure that this committee runs smoothly and that we have all the things that we need to do our work for the state of Alaska. And so Betty, her commitment to this committee, it reflects her dedication to the committee and the members of the committee and the Alaska State Legislature and the state of Alaska. And so I want to appreciate your service today and also wish you a happy birthday. And so we'll take a brief at ease. We're back on the record. Happy birthday, Betty. Today's agenda consists of initial hearings on two bills, HB 115, Aquatic Farming and Hatchery Site Leases, and SB 44, Personal Use Fishing Priority, which will be heard and held. Then we'll have a presentation about the Susitna-Watonna Hydroelectric Project. So let's get started with HB 115. I'd like to welcome Representative Andy Story and our staff, Greg Smith, to the Resources Committee. And Representative Story, when you're ready, if you could please place yourself on the record and walk us through this bill.
Thank you, Chair Rivak and members of the Senate Resources Committee. I am Andy Story, representing District 34, and pleased to be here today. I am very pleased to offer House Bill 115, which simplifies the Department of Natural Resources lease renewal process for aquatic farms directly supporting Alaskan aquaculture businesses. Aquatic farm products include oysters, kelp, and other shellfish. This is an industry with substantial promise. In fact, the Alaska Mariculture Task Force set a goal of making this industry $100 million industry in the next 20 years. With Alaska's clean waters and immense coastline, we have a huge potential for responsible development of this industry. I was pleased at how far this bill progressed last session, getting through the House to Senate Finance, its last committee of referral before COVID shortened our session. There are many hurdles for business owners to overcome when operating a small mariculture enterprise. This bill addresses one obstacle. Specifically, it expedites the lease renewal process. In doing so, it lowers investment risk for these startup businesses and reduces the workload on an overstretched state agency, DNR, allowing the regulatory agency to process lease applications of all types more quickly. Due to recent state budget cuts and an increase in aquatic farm lease applications, It currently takes DNR 18 months or more to approve an initial or renewal aquatic farm lease. This bill would align aquatic farm lease renewals to be consistent with other DNR lease renewals, such as those for agricultural grazing, cabins and lodges, docks and hydroelectric facilities, who are allowed a streamlined renewal process. House Bill 115 does not affect salmon hatchery leases. The streamlined process allows the director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water to renew a lease for a business in good standing and takes around 90 days. Including mariculture businesses to this list significantly shortens the renewal process while still allowing appropriate regulatory oversight, public engagement, and requests for appeal of any DNR lease renewal decision. Last session, when the bill was in Senate Finance, the committee added the reporting requirements of an initial and annual report. It had a section that explicitly allowed ecotourism and educational functions and prohibited the department from charging access or transit fees. I incorporated these changes into this session's bill. In addition, this year on the House floor, an amendment by Representative Vance was unanimously approved. The amendment specified that the reports required in the sections to be delivered electronically. I appreciated the maker of the amendment focusing on efficiency and cost savings in government. After the adoption of the amendment, House Bill 115 passed the House 40-0. After passage, two issues were brought to our attention by DNR, and that is found, I spoke with Chair Rivak and the members, and that hopefully will be in the committee substitute that is before us today, and my staff, Greg Smith, is going to walk us through those proposals from DNR.
Perfect. Please, Mr. Smith, put yourself on the record and walk us through those.
Very good. Thank you, Chair Rivak and members of the Senate Resources Committee. The two issues that were brought to our attention had to do with the term ecotourism and also the prohibition of fees subsection. Ecotourism is not currently defined in statute, and therefore the plain meaning is used. There was concern by the department that the current kind of a common definition includes, for ecotourism, includes tourism directed towards exotic or often threatened natural environments. The concern was that if in the future someone interpreted that the allowance provided for in subsection H maybe would not stick because these sites used for aquatic farms may not be considered exotic or threatened. The second change is in the prohibition of fees subsection. The concern there was that the previous language was too broad and might have prohibited and would have prohibited the department from charging fees for several actions that they currently charge for, including amendments or changes to leases, subleases, or transfers of leases. So the CS narrows the prohibition on fees that the department can charge to only not allowing fees for tourism enterprises or educational purposes, which was our understanding was the original intent of the language when it was added in Senate Finance last year. And from our understanding, the people in the industry, growers, as well as the department, are happy with the change proposed in the forthcoming committee substitute.
Okay, thank you. Do members of the committee have any questions about this committee substitute before we adopt it? Mr. Vice Chair, could I get a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to adopt the committee substitute for HB 115 version 32-LS0299/O.
Thank you. Are there any objections? All right, seeing no objections, the committee substitute is in front of us. We'll now move on to invited testimony. We have Heather McCarty online, the chairman of the Mariculture Task Force. Heather, if you could please put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Heather McCarty, presenting testimony on behalf of the Alaska Mariculture Task Force. As you said, Mr. Chairman, I'm the chairman of that task force, and we would like to express strong support for House Bill 115 and for the committee substitute that you just presented. We believe that it's an important part of a larger plan to fully develop the mariculture industry in Alaska. We also believe that the growth of the mariculture industry can play an important role in Alaska's economic recovery from the COVID-19 disaster. And passage of this bill is central to fully enabling that economic potential. Just to give you a little history about the task force and its members, it was established in 2016 by Governor Walker, and members were appointed that represent a wide range of stakeholders. There are community development quota associations, ASGA, the Alaska Shellfish Growers Association, other interest groups in mariculture, including hatcheries and seaweed producers, as well as Alaska Native representation. In 2018, we developed and completed a statewide comprehensive plan to accelerate the development of mariculture. It's called the Alaska Mariculture Development Plan, and I think as part of your materials, you may have a summary of that plan. We can provide a full plan as needed. In the development of that plan, we used what we called working groups. They were basically committees that were made up of experts in various aspects of the development of mariculture in Alaska, education and outreach, science and research, marketing and processing, and regulatory and statutory changes that might be necessary to remove obstacles to development of mariculture. In that process, we identified in that development plan several DNR issues, some of which could be addressed in regulation changes, and some which needed to be addressed by statutory changes. And this legislation is a direct result of some of those findings in our main strategic plan. We were reauthorized in 2018 to work towards implementation of that plan, and we produced, by the end of 2019, a five-year action plan. In that plan, again, there was a recognized need to do potential statutory change as well as regulatory change to remove some of the obstacles to development. Governor Dunleavy, upon his election, kept the task force in place, as he also shares the vision of what mariculture could mean to the state, jobs and opportunities. So I wanted to let you guys know that House Bill 115 and the committee substitute has broad stakeholder support, and we believe, again, that it's an important step towards development of the industry. You've heard about the main focus of the bill, which is to align the lease renewal process for aquatic farms and hatcheries with the lease renewal process for most other types of state leases. This change would simplify and shorten that process. It would reduce the workload on DNR staff and provide the mariculture / aquaculture businesses with more certainty. Again, it has a simpler reporting requirement for DNR that would allow the Alaska legislature to better keep track and understand the growth of the industry. And it puts into statute that tourism and educational purposes are allowed on aquatic farms and hatchery sites. I'm happy to answer any questions about the development of these statutory changes through the task force and our continued support for this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Heather. Do we have any questions? All right. We appreciate that. And if you have not already submitted your testimony in writing, could you please do that? Do you have that written out?
I can certainly do that, I will, absolutely.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your willingness and time to be here to testify. And next, we're going to move on and hear from Eric Wyatt, president of Alaska Shellfish Growers Association, Eric, please put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Yep. Good afternoon. This is Eric Wyatt. Right, as you said, I'm president of Alaska Shellfish Growers Association. So mostly we include a number of predominantly oyster farms from Homer to Ketchikan, pretty much the bulk of the industry, the biggest bulk. And I'm also, I've been a long-time member here, original member of the task force, along with Heather. And I'm also a director of Oceans Alaska Science Center and Shellfish Hatchery down in Ketchikan. And I've been aquatic farming for getting on to 20 years now, predominantly oysters and also a bit of kelp. And so I've been involved in, personally involved in lease renewals, initial leases, every different type of modification. And I'd say that this bill is worthwhile, and it responsibly improves aquatic farming lease program. So thank you for considering it. As Heather stated, you know, this bill, along with some few regulatory improvements that we worked out, we was a large body of people, though, with the task force. They're going to fix some important problems and concerns. So the Shellfish Growers Association supports this bill as proposed here, and I encourage you to approve it. And thank you for your careful consideration and to Representative Story for all her hard work, and also happy birthday to Betty. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. We will let her know. And also, if you have testimony you could provide in writing, you can send it to SRES@akleg.gov, SRES@akleg.gov. And lastly, we will hear from Paul Foose. Paul, if you could, from Alaska Longneck Firms. Paul, if you could please put yourself on the record and begin.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Paul Foose with Alaska Longneck Firms. And for about 15 years now, I've been involved as a commercial diver in the geoid duck mariculture industry, and I do am a lease holder and for a lease site down around Ketchikan. And I want to say that this is a good bill and thank Representative Story for it. However, it does raise some other issues in terms of leasing that I've raised with the sponsor, and you know, I think they wanted to get the bill moving. Everyone realizes these are real issues, and perhaps there are some that need to be taken up in a separate bill next year. However, there's one amendment that would be very helpful to the geoid duck industry, and it has to do with the specific nature of the biology of geoid ducks. And I sent down some pictures. I don't know if you guys have seen those, that you can kind of see what these animals look like. They're pretty big. They grow up to a kilogram. They mature in 7 years after you plant them, roughly 7 years. Can sell for as much as $20 to $30 a piece, primarily in the Chinese markets. Well, the issue is that once you hold a lease, the Department of Natural Resources, in order to maintain that lease, says you have to sell $15,000 worth of product a year. And within the first 7 years, that's impossible, and because you can't grow a geoid duck in less than 7 years. So beyond that, there's a lot of reasons for during a particular year you wouldn't harvest a geoid duck. You might have paralytic shellfish poisoning. We're in the middle of a trade war with China, COVID, you know, any of those things. And the nice thing about a geoid duck is that if you can't harvest it 1 year, you just leave it in the ground and it just gets bigger. And geoid ducks will live up to 150 years old. So this is a major impediment to investment, because what happens is that the department says if you don't sell $15,000 worth of product a year, your lease can be revoked. So when we talk to our investors, we have to tell them, they say, do you have site control? Do you have control? And we have to disclose to them, no, at any time our leases could be taken if we don't sell $15,000 a year of product. So we've been assured by the department that this would only be selectively enforced. And, you know, for some people that might provide some comfort. For others, it might indicate some concern. So we're asking for that simple amendment to say that the finding of use of your site is the planting of seed. A very simple amendment that if you've planted seed, and it's a technical process, you have to apply to Fishing Game to get the certificate to transport the seed, give them your whole plan, and they verified that you planted it. Harvesting is a whole separate issue. So we're at the point now here that we have to make some major investments because we've had problems getting seed for gooey ducks. For oysters, you can get them from outside because they're not indigenous here. For us, they're indigenous. We have to have local species. We have to run a hatchery here. The only hatchery's been sewered. And then when we try to transport the spat, what happens is, of course, they have to come in seawater. They have to be oxygenated. Well, you can't bring it on the plane because of the TSA requirements on liquid. So now you're putting it in cargo. And I don't know what all experiences you've had, but every once in a while, the people handling cargo don't do so well handling it. So we've had really substantial dead loss. So, you know, that's why we need it. And so if you could consider that one amendment that would just state that proof of the use of a lease is the planting of seed, not some arbitrary dollar figure of sales, that would really help us. I'm going to raise just a couple other issues real quick that need to be looked at long term. And that is, the law says, as you read it, you can only renew your lease one time. But it's a 10-year lease. Well, we've got a product that we've been on our leases now for 14 years. And so with a 7-year grow out, we're to the point, would we plant now? Because how do we know that we're going to actually get our lease renewed? You can only get it renewed once. Now we're right back to the same process, you know, of getting a new lease. And we don't even know what that process is because this hasn't been laid out. And what do we do with the animals we've already planted? And we don't know if we're going to get the new lease. So that's why in the House they actually looked at, the other body, I'm sorry, looked at, maybe we do a longer lease. But then the factor there is if you go beyond 10 years, you have to do an actual survey, which would cost up to $45,000. So these issues need to be dealt with, you know, long-term in a separate bill. But I do think that it'd be very helpful if the committee could accept an amendment that would say the planting of seed is proof of the use of the lease site. Over.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Does anybody have anybody in the room or online can shed any light on what Mr. Foos had to say? How about Christy Colas? Are you there?
Hi. For the record, this is Christy Colas, the Chief of Operations for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water.
Yes.
Senator, through the chair, can you repeat the question, Chairman? I'm sorry.
Thanks, Chief Colas. I was just wondering if you heard what Mr. Foos was saying related to gooey ducks and specifically planting seed means that they're utilizing a lease. I just was wondering if you had any comments related to this issue.
Chairman, yes, we are aware of the situation that Mr. Paul Foos is bringing to the committee's attention. And, you know, we do have in our regulations that do talk about the commercial use requirement. But we also in our regulations have the ability for us to consider situations that the lessee brings to our attention, such as the issues that Mr. Foos identified, such as PSP, market changes, any other factors that might cause a farmer to not be able to sell their product. So we have not denied or revoked any leases based off of not meeting the commercial use requirement. And also when that was established in regulation, that was prior to a lot of gooey duck understanding coming online of the maturity of gooey ducks being 7 years. So it is something that we recognize needs to be addressed when we redo our regulations. But that is something that we have on the docket that we have we just need to get to. We just haven't yet. But because our regulations allow us to consider other factors, we are not closing leases because they're not meeting commercial use requirements.
Yeah, thank you. We have a question from Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So when do you think you might review those regulations?
Senator, through the chair, so at this time, we have a long list. We have our water regulations and some mining regulations and fee regulations that are currently being gone out through public notice. We're dealing with comments. So where they're at on the list, I would say they're probably another year out before we could probably actually get to our aquatic farm regulations.
Is that follow-up?
Follow-up.
So then the other thing that the testifier indicated was having only one lease renewal. Does your regulations address that?
Senator, through the chair, so at this time, what we're trying to get with this bill is the ability to renew for an additional term without going through a second, it's called a best interest finding that has to go out for public notice. We take comments, and then we write another decision kind of addressing those comments. And so what this bill will do is take that requirement away so we can just look at the file, see what's been done with the farm. Have they paid all their fees? Have they been in communication with us? Have they met all the requirements? And then we can renew it without going out for that decision process, public notice process. And we do notice the public of the decision, but it really helps us to narrow that decision process down and make it more timely. And so that way we can actually make it quicker. But after that, then yes, we would have to go back out for another decision process. But it doesn't mean they won't get a new lease.
So,
yes, please.
Thank you. So I understand that the bill is allowing for one renewal. So I think it's Fuse, said that he has a 10-year lease, then he renew it with another 10-year lease, but after 20 years, and he's in year 14, but after 20 years, he would have to go out and get a whole new application, it sounds like, and potentially pay, was he quoted, you know, $40,000 for an appraisal or whatever it is. Is that correct?
Senator Van Hoff, through the chair, no. So he would not have to do the survey or the appraisal unless he wanted to try to pursue a lease longer than a 10-year term. So we can do leases, according to statute, up to 55 years. But after 10 years, according to statute, we have to have an appraisal done for us to issue that lease. So he would have to reapply after he got that another renewal. We would then adjudicate, and if he wanted to remain at a 10-year lease, he would not be required to get a survey or an appraisal.
Okay, well, last question. Thank you. Okay, so how – this is, from what I understand, somewhat emerging now because we're getting new GUI duck information. So can any leaseholder then get three leases in a row? So over a course of 30 years, he or she can avoid getting – an appraisal and all the other fees, so they could just re-up it and tell their investors, oh, yeah, we're pretty confident we can re-up it every 10 years?
Senator Von Hoff, through the chair, correct. So they can just continue to request that renewal after 10 years, and they will not have to pay those fees. And as long as they remain and they're not in default and it's found to be in the best interest of the state, then we would be able to renew that lease for as many terms as they requested. And we do consider public comment periods. That's why we have one renewal of similar term before we go back out with another decision process to allow the public to weigh in. Maybe things have changed, conditions have changed. That would maybe cause us to maybe go in another direction. But that in my time here, and I've been here 15 years, I have not seen that happen yet.
I truly have one last question.
Go ahead, please.
Do you allow bidding wars?
Senator Van Hoff, through the chair, no. I mean, we could have a bid potentially, or competing application, we would call it. But thus far, usually farmers can kind of pick their own spot, and we haven't had to come across that situation. Haven't had to do a competing application for an aquatic farm at this time.
Thank you, Christy. Are there any questions? Yes, Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, on a slightly different section of the bill,
mm-hmm.
I think I know the answer, but I want to make sure. It's section, I think it's 4 of the CS. It takes renewals out of the area where the commissioner can deny an application for good cause. And I didn't get through the whole statute book. Does the department retain that ability elsewhere if there is some good cause?
Senator Keel, through the chair, yes. So we do have the ability still to review the lease and the case file to ensure that it's been in good standing. So we can still deny based off of good cause if we so find it. And we also can choose not to renew the lease through this expedited process if there's reason to believe that we need to go through a full review process and decision process. And also at the end of this decision process, there's always the opportunity for the farmer or for the commenting public to appeal.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you all for being here, willing to testify. I think at this point, given the time, we're going to move on. Mr. Foose, if you could please work with the bill sponsor. We'll work with the bill sponsor as well to talk about this. And we'll bring this bill before us at a later date for further consideration. So thank you very much, Representative Story.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. You're welcome. So next we're going to move on to SB 44, personal use fishing priority. In the room we have Joe Hayes, staff to Senator Kawasaki. And I know that Senator Kawasaki is out and about and unavailable to be here today. He is excused. And so we're glad to have Mr. Hayes. What we're going to do here is we're just going to have you present the bill, and then we're going to hold this for further consideration. So with that, Mr. Hayes, please put yourself on the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Hayes, staff to Senator Kawasaki. Sorry you couldn't be here today. And I will be introducing Senate Bill 44, priority use of personal use of fish priority. I'm sorry to say our intern was to present this bill, and his term ended Sunday, so I am going to do this in his stead. So let me start with the sponsor statement. Senate Bill 44, an act providing priority to personal use fisheries when fishing restrictions are implemented to achieve a management goal. Excluding the priorities already in statute for subsistence, Senate Bill 44 directs the Board of Fisheries to place restrictions on sports and commercial fisheries before putting restrictions on personal use fisheries when the harvest is limited to achieve a management goal. Fisheries that are restricted to residents only are intended to enable Alaskans to access their fisheries resources for their personal use and consumption. Ensuring that residents have access to these fisheries resources is vitally important as we continue to grow as a state. All Alaskans can agree that residents should be prioritized for harvest of our fisheries resources before users from elsewhere in the country and the world. Currently, there are 41 personal use fisheries throughout the state. Harvest species include salmon, whitefish, shrimp, clam, crab, scallop, herring, smelt, abalone, sea cucumber, halibut, and more. Nearly 50,000 Alaskans rely on personal use fisheries every year to put food on their family's dinner table. Personal use fisheries provide food security, contribute to the economy, and support the Alaskan traditions of independence, self-determination, and resourcefulness. Senator Kawasaki asks for your consideration and support of Senate Bill 44 so Alaskans can be assured that they will continue to have access to their fisheries resources to the benefit of themselves and their families. And really quick, Mr. Chairman, for the sectional analysis, the sectional amends Alaska Statute 16.05.251 to read that the Board of Fisheries will restrict all other fisheries before personal use fisheries when implementing restrictions to achieve the escapement of the number of the stock that will sustain the fisheries. And Mr. Chair, our intern, Max Robichaud, put together a PowerPoint really quick that I'd like to just go through, if that's okay.
Sure. Yes, please.
Okay, so the intent for Senate Bill 44 is an effort to increase food security for the state of Alaska. Senate Bill 44 ensures that all Alaskans have priority access to the state's rich abundance of nutritious seafood. Senate Bill 44 provides for the prioritization of personal use fisheries in the event of a closure, ensuring a management goal is met. Personal use fisheries provide an extremely valuable food source to Alaskans. In 2019, 21,479 personal use permit holders caught 457,002 pounds of sockeye salmon from Cook Inlet personal use fisheries. To buy the equivalent amount of sockeye salmon from a Fred Meyer's in Fairbanks, Juneau, or Anchorage, it would cost an average of $1,962.80 per permit holder. And a report from a family who dip netted in 2019 shows that they paid $2.64 a pound for 80.6 pounds of fillets that they ate throughout the year. At a retail value of $805.19, this was a $592.42 cost savings on 80.6 pounds of sockeye salmon. This is a significant cost savings that help Alaskans have easier access to high quality food. And this slide, let's see. In this slide, we wanted to show the difference between what a commercial organization was able to receive over a 10-year period versus dip netting folks doing individual dip netting in Kenai. You see a marked difference in what commercial folks bring in versus dip netters. In conclusion, Senate Bill 44 provides for a common sense measure ensuring that all Alaskans are able to have access to our state's abundance of nutrient-rich seafoods. And with that, I do believe I have folks online who want to testify, and I'm open for questions, Mr. Chair and members.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Hayes. I do not believe we will take public testimony today. We will take that at a further, at a later date. We do have one more presentation here today. And so I thank you for being here to present this bill. Well done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we will notice public testimony next time. I would encourage the folks online who would like to provide testimony, please provide that in writing to SRES@akleg.gov. We'll be glad to post those in with the bill packet, and we'll let you know when we're going to open public testimony in the future. Yes, we'll take a brief at ease. All right, we are back on the record. Next, we have a presentation. All right, we're back on the record. Next, we have a presentation on the Susitna-Watonna Hydroelectric Project. Online, we have Curtis Thayer, Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. Mr. Thayer, thank you so much for being here with us on a Friday afternoon. We look forward to your presentation. Please put yourself on the record and begin.
Thank you. My name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. And with me, I have Kirk Warren, who is our Director of Engineering and Energy Development, along with Brian Carey with Owned Assets, with our Hydro Group, who was the engineer on the Susitna-Watonna project back in 2014-15, and Brandy Dixon, our Director of Communications. The first on slide number 2 is just a comparison of a U.S. and Alaska energy profile. The first pie chart is the current U.S. In the middle is the Alaska, currently where we're at. Where we are in comparison to the lower 48, we are 27% hydroelectric, where only 2% of the U.S. is. However, there's a little higher in renewable, 9% and 2% for Alaska. But clearly, we're moving ahead of the United States as far as renewable and hydroelectric, and we can actually put those in the same box. The third slide on your right just indicates where Alaska would be if Susitna-Wantana was built. Again, I want to preference that this is from 2014 and 15. This majority of this slide packet, this is for informational purposes at that time. AEA has not spent any money going forward and updating these numbers as we go through the presentation. But it just gives you a little bit of a flavor of where we could be. There's a goal of we'll have 50% renewable in the state by 2025. Obviously, we're not going to reach that goal right now where we're at, but clearly with the Susitna-Wantana type size, we would be at close to 60%. Slide number 3 just references existing U.S. hydro facilities in Alaska. There's 48 states that have hydro projects. The largest one that we do have in Alaska is the Bradley Lake Hydro Project. It is owned by AEA. It's at the head of Kachemak Bay and produces about 120 megawatts of power, which is roughly about 10% of the Braille Belt. We recently did a diversion project called Battle Creek at $47 million, which should increase the capacity, or it is increasing the capacity, I should say. Bringing power onto the rail belt. And that rail belt, when I say that, that's from Homer to all the way to Fairbanks. Fairbanks receives 17% of the Bradley Lake hydropower approximately. But it gives you a little bit of flavor. And for dams over 500 megawatts, you'll find that specifically there in the Pacific Northwest, and clearly Susitna-Wantana would be at 600 megawatts, would be one of those larger size dams than we have in the country. As far as Susitna-Wantana itself, which is on slide 5, and that is in 2014, an administrative AO-271 was placed on Susitna Hydro Project, and it was put into abeyance. It was a mega project, the state had fiscal issues, and it was literally put on a shelf. And in 2019, through AO-309, Governor Dunleavy rescinded AO-271, and in fiscal year 2020, no state funds were spent on Susitna-Wantana, and that remains the case today. As far as state energy policy, in 2010, the legislature passed unanimously that we would have 50% of the state's electricity from renewables or alternative, and we're not there yet. We've slowly moved up the scale, and you can tell in the next slide why we say large hydro is because we've moved from 21 to 27. We've reduced our dependency on coal and primarily natural gas. But clearly we're not, you know, with that, we're at 29%, 30%, not the 50% goal that was hoped for 11 years ago. As far as AEA, the Alaska State Legislature granted AEA the powers of authority to acquire a Susitna power project, whether by construction, purchase, lease, and to perform feasibility studies and engineering design with respect to that project. And that was statutory mandated, and that work was completed when that was done in the earlier part of the decade, last decade, and the state spent roughly $193 million towards FERC license. When people say, why Susitna-Wantana? Well, it would increase 50% estimated supply of our current rail belt energy demand. The project is anticipated to be well over 100 years in long-term stable rates. And in 2014, the estimated cost savings was over $11 billion to the consumers along the rail belt. I think another thing that's important to note is the reduction of carbon dioxide emissions from displaced coal and natural gas generation would amount to 1.3 million tons a year, which equates to removing approximately 250,000 cars from the road. Currently, DMV has 620,000 cars registered in Alaska. So it would eliminate more than a third of the carbon of the sorry the dioxide emissions by doing a project such as the Sitna. A little bit about the project history. It was done. It started in 1950 by the Bureau of Reclamation. The state legislature put a lot of study into it in the 1980s, and of course we had a dip in oil prices. Therefore, the project was shelved. In 2010, the state had the established goal of 50% by 2025. The legislature unanimously authorized the Energy Authority to pursue the Sitna Hydro Project, and studies were begun in 2012. And then the license and everything was put into abeyance in 2017, and like I previously said, it came out of abeyance in 2019. When you look at the map here on the next slide, it gives you a rough proposal. The star represents where the dam will be, and then you have the upper Sitna in red, and then you'll see the middle in blue, and then down to the lower in yellow where it goes into Cook Inlet. So it kind of gives you a rough perspective of where the dam will be. As a project at a glance, the project dam height is about 700 feet high. The dam elevation from sea level is about 2,000. The reservoir it would create would be 42 miles with a reservoir width of about 1.25 miles, and the installed capacity would be a little over 600 megawatts. The need at the time that this study was done back in 2014-15 by the utilities was roughly around 400, 450 megawatts. So what that does is hopefully bring low-cost energy onto the railroad to invite new businesses, new businesses to operate with lower-cost energy. And when we talk about lower-cost energy, and again, this is going back to 2014-15 numbers, and Bradley Lake is about 4 to 4.5 cents a kilowatt, and natural gas in Cook Inlet is running 7 to 9 cents a kilowatt. And as we deplete that resource, I'm sure that will go up. And at the time that this was done, the numbers was about 6 to 6.5 cents a kilowatt for Sitna. And really, to move this project forward or to look at the next steps, we need to redo those cost estimates to see if that 6, 6.5 cents, if that number still holds true, if it's gotten better, or if it's gone higher. And if it's getting higher and it starts to compete more with natural gas, then again, that's the time for the policymakers to see if the project is ripe to continue. So again, I think we just need first thing is we need to find out if that 6, 6.5 cents holds true. The annual energy is 2,800,000 megawatts, and the cost in 2014 dollars is approximately $5.5 billion, $5.6 billion. Again, that is a number that needs to be looked at again, just because as technology has changed, there is possible ways that we could construct this cheaper. Money is cheaper to procure as far as finding investment at lower dollar amounts. You know, right now we're looking at 1-2% money on the market, 3%, which is a lot different than it was in 2014. Again, that's just one of the factors that will affect the price of the kilowatt. One thing to look at too, when we talk about a dam of this size, it would be the fifth largest dam in the United States. Not in the world. There's dams well over 1,000 feet in China and other parts of the world. But in Alaska, it would be the fifth largest. And it would be rough, and when you look at it, it's about six times larger than Bradley Lake that we currently operate. So just kind of give you a little bit of background with that. As far as engineering, it was sized and generation was optimized. The design was reviewed by the International Board of Consultants. It's designed to withstand a 10,000-year flood and the maximal credible earthquake of magnitude of 8.0, and we had a 2014 engineering feasibility report. Again, there's no showstoppers to say this can't be built. Technology allows it to be built. Some of the economics of it, and again, this goes back to 2015-2014. And that is based on that, the benefit-cost ratio was 2.39 from energy savings alone. We discussed the $11 billion in energy savings over 50 years, and about 4.7 in capital and O&M costs for the first 50 years of operation. The employment opportunities, over 32,000 total jobs, direct and indirect jobs. That goes from pre-construction employment to actually construction and the operation of the plant itself. When we look at that, primarily it'll be during the construction phase, which is about 9 to 11 years of those employment numbers. As far as licensing, we use the integrated licensing process. The state, with $193 million, they're approximately two-thirds of the way through licensure. And with that, we did 58 FERC-approved studies and were implemented between 2012 and 2017. 19 studies were completed and 39 where significant progress were made. And the initial study report was filed with FERC. And we anticipated somewhere around $100 million to complete the FERC application. So we're two-thirds of the way through and need about a third more time and money in that. I think it's important to note with the FERC study, it confirmed the accuracy of the environmental studies. It validated the quality of work completed to date. It rejected nearly all the study modification requests, rejected requests for additional years of study, confirmed data thus far representing all the baselines, and rejected requests for additional studies, and licensing activity currently is in abeyance. So really the outcome of that FERC study was very beneficial, provided a lot of background, and gives us a way to look towards the future of what needs to be completed.
So Mr. Thayer, if you could pause there for a second, if we have any questions. I had one real quick on the FERC. So you said we're two-thirds of the way there, so essentially the state of Alaska has spent somewhere around $200 million on this FERC license. We have somewhere around $100 million to go. If I heard you right, if that's wrong, please correct me. What does that FERC license then get us? Where are we at when we have that?
Once you have Mr. Chair, you are correct in the timeline and the funding as far as approximately $100 million. What that FERC license is the approval to move ahead, and there we could go into obviously looking for the investment and also the construction of the dam itself. So it is the federal okay to move forward once we have that license.
Thank you, Mr. And so when we do have that license, then that's something of value to the state of Alaska. Otherwise, we have $200 million in sunk costs, essentially. Is that correct?
That is correct. One could look at it a couple of different ways, and that is if the license was completed for another $100 million and we had $300 million into it, at that time the state could look at, depending on the ownership of the dam, if there's a private party that wished to own and operate the dam, or if it was a private public partnership, there's a couple different scenarios, that $300 million could go towards the lessening the cost of the dam to the consumer, or maybe there's the possibility the state actually would benefit and somebody would buy the license. But again, you would first have to have a license. I will say this, that there is, you know, I think a lot of it is because financing is fairly cheap, and the fact of somebody looking at earning a rate of return at 4 to 6% for the next 50 years, there is interest by multiple parties that easily could finance this project, that would be looking for a project with a FERC license. We don't have a project with a FERC license, but if we did, there are several parties that I think would be knocking at our door, and they're already knocking and asking details about the project, and we provide them the public information that's readily available. We would anticipate that a FERC license would take 2 years once the studies are completed. And then you would go into the project execution phase. Construction would be 9 to 11 years before the dam is operational. So if this dam was to move forward, we're at probably about 15 years at a minimum if we got the green light to move forward and start the FERC process to the time it's actually built. We are looking at about 15 years.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That sounds like quite the opportunity. Just the last question before I hand it over. Other members have questions here as well. But you mentioned that the estimated cost per kilowatt hour upon completion of the dam, and I know that's a little fluid, but did you say 6 cents? Did I hear that right?
That's correct. 6 to 6.5 cents a kilowatt. And again, that's compared to Bradley Lake, which is roughly 4 to 4.5 cents a kilowatt. And then you have the natural gas being generated power here on the rail belt, and that's around 7 to 9 cents a kilowatt.
All right, thank you. And just a quick follow-up to that. Would then that cost per kilowatt hour then over time decrease, given that the after we pay back the loan?
Well, I think more importantly, Mr. Chair, I think more importantly, it could be better characterized as price won't increase as opposed will it decrease. It's because you do have a dam that you've built, you've got to finance, it will be financed over 50 years, but the price will not continue to increase. We're seeing that with natural gas, and particularly in Cook Inlet, the prices continue to increase, and you know, there's even a discussion of importing natural gas into Cook Inlet for the rail belt energy needs, not only for natural gas to heat your home, but also for electricity generation. So what this will do is stop increases.
Thank you. We have a question from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. The first, I guess, would be, you know, I've got a hydro project that's just about primed to go in my district. It's got its FERC license, but I think the private developer who wants to build that paid those costs. Why is it that the state is covering the cost of getting this one to FERC license if we've got interested private partners?
Well, that's through the chair, Senator Keel. That's a very good question. You know, the state took it upon itself back in 2014 and 15 to do the FERC license. And I think part of that had to do with the size of the dam, the benefits of the dam to 550,000 residents was a policy call by the legislature and by the governor at that time. And really, if that was to change again, that would be a policy call by the governor and this legislature, how they would like to move forward. I'm familiar with the project in Juneau that you speak of, but that dam, in comparison, is roughly 19 to 20, or it's actually 19.9 megawatts, and this one is 600 megawatts. So there's quite a size difference too.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, another question. So it sounds like cost to construct somewhere in the, $6.5 billion project, just roughly bringing 5.6 forward from 7 years ago. Is that the total cost, including all the power lines are going to have to come in and the cost to connect into utilities, all the switching gear and all that stuff that a power producer is going to have to fund? Or is that just a dam construction? Excuse me, dam construction cost.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you for the question. That is the 5.6 is the construction of the dam itself. There needs to be power. There needs to be upgrades to the transmission lines. Whether Susitna-Wantana is built or not, those upgrades are needed, and the utilities are working together to develop a plan to do that, just that. We also have where we're constrained, where the power would come off of Susitna-Wantana, we're just as constrained down in the off of Bradley, where we have 120 megawatt plant, and the lines that service it are 75 megawatts. And so those upgrades are needed with or without Susitna being built. We still need to do those upgrades. So that does not count in the $5.6 billion cost.
Mr. Chairman, that's an interesting notion. It'd be good to dig a little deeper into that. I know those can be surprising sometimes. And if we're looking at possibly an independent producer being the owner of that, who bears those costs and where those economics go sometimes catches people up. Thank you.
Yeah, and maybe Mr. Thayer wants to respond to that. The dam construction costs are expensive. Do we know what the cost of the transmission might be, Mr. Thayer?
Mr. Chair, the approximate cost, if we were to do all the upgrades on the transmission lines in South Central, we're probably looking at close to $900 to $1 billion.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff has a question.
Sort of just kind of reminds me about the port, you know. billion here, a billion there. Anyway, the good news is that I think you mentioned earlier it'll take 9 to 11 years to actually construct the dam, so we'll have 9 to 11 years to also figure out how to pay for and prioritize which of the transmission lines that we need to upgrade first to access this newly formed dam. But the question that I have for you is what I'm hearing is that while the federal government with the Biden administration is really excited about alternative energy projects, the bureaucracy of federal permitting and FERC licensing has not changed across administrations, and it is still the slow as molasses process. Have you in your position with Alaska Energy Authority and going through the licensing process for, I'm sure, smaller projects around the state, what has your experience been the last couple of years and especially in the last couple months about permitting process with the federal government?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator von Inhofe. As we've not, with some of the projects, well, let me back up. There is federal legislation that Senator Murkowski has introduced, that Senator Murkowski passed when she was chair of the Energy Committee, that was hopeful to streamline the FERC process and to shorten the deadlines in for which they needed to provide answers, and at the same time lengthen the amount of time that you could hold a license before your project is built. We have not, since that legislation has passed, we have not gone through a start to finish to really kind of time it, so to speak, to see if it actually is more efficient. But in theory, Congress did try to make it more efficient a couple of years ago.
In theory.
We just haven't tested it.
All right, Mr. Thayer, if you could finish up with your presentation here.
All right. Well, towards our last slide here, which is last 19, is, you know, the governor and the legislature needs to decide the next steps. I think our proposal here at AEA, and we've said this to other legislators and said to the governor, the first thing we need is to determine the licensing status. Does the state want to move ahead with a license? And then you would need to stage gate the next steps. And that is we need to update the cost estimate to obtain a license. We need to update the benefit, cost, and economic impact analysis to find out if the numbers still hold, it is a project we want to move forward. And we need to make sure we review data to ensure it remains reflective of current conditions. Things have changed over the last 5 to 6 years. We also not only need to consult with FERC, but the landowners and all the stakeholders. We have had conversations, AEA has had conversations with the utilities, and they are interested in pursuing Susitna and Wantana. They individual boards have mandated that they reduce their carbon footprint and go more renewable. And this would take all the this would answer all the utilities' mandates in one project. There is not a different project on the rail belt that would get the state to 50%, let alone the majority of the 550,000 residents along the rail belt get them to majority of renewable. But again, it needs to be a stage gate approach. I don't want to leave the impression that this is a green-lighted project in the sense that it's ready to go. There's a lot of steps within these five bullet points that would need to be done first before we should restart and make a final decision or a recommendation to the governor and to the legislature what that next step should be. And with that, I'm available for questions. Again, Brian Carey, who was the was on the engineering team the last time, and also Kirk Warren with our energy development is also available for questions.
Do we get to see this really cool animation, maybe?
Is this video, Mr. Thayer, is the same as we saw last time?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is. We chose to. You've seen it once, so we did not queue it up to be seen again, but you're more than welcome to view it.
The Mission Impossible simulations. Senator von Imhoff. I have a question. Whose responsibility are these five bullets that you just spoke of, and how Is that some, are any of these things that the AEA or anybody else that you're aware of in the administration looking into?
Mr. Chair, since the state legislature gave the authority to AEA, all five bullets would fall to AEA to perform. But one thing is, and that is the guidance from the governor and the legislature are to decide the next steps. These are all operational issues we can do, but really the policy to move forward rests with the legislature and the governor.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff has a question.
Is it the policy or is it the $100 million that you need?
Through the chair, actually it would be both.
Yeah, Senator Machicki has a question.
So I may not have been, you may have already discussed this, and I hope you haven't, but if you have, that's okay. I had another appointment, I'm sorry. So previous administration halts the program on something we've been kicking around for, 40-something years, is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, you are correct. Since actually the 1950s, so we're going closer to 60, 70 years.
Since the initial study. So what is the chance, since the Biden administration is really focused on renewable energy sources, that they might be very interested in this project? I know there's resistance from some, and I've noticed that some of the resistance has, in my view, moved into some fairly, I hate to say it this way, but a little bit of a stretch, such as the carbon footprint increase due to the removal of trees and things like that. Ultimately, cleanest form of energy, renewable, huge proportion of the energy utilized in the rail belt. Who's on lead for this? Is the governor back excited about this project? We have a different governor. Who needs to really be on point for getting us rolling again?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, the governor Dunleavy did take this out of abeyance and put it back to move forward. We have had discussions with the congressional delegation on Susitna-Wantana. I think it's safe to say that they're all champions of the project, but again, the funding and the policy of the state legislature and the governor needs to be first thought out. But we have taken time to educate the Biden administration and the delegation if there might be opportunities that for the FERC license, for example, if the federal government wanted to look at that $100 million. Again, there seems to be a lot of money available, but a lot of it is kind of unknown, the rules and the parameters around it. But we've had conversations and have shown this to be what we would consider a shovel-ready project. It's not shovel-ready in the sense that you can build it tomorrow, but for a project that could take Alaska to 60% renewable and provide 25,000-30,000 jobs in the meantime in doing that and lower the cost of energy for the next 100 years on the rail belt, there's a lot of pluses to this project.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I agree completely, and I just, I can't help but to wonder where we'd be at if we had actually built this 50 years ago right now in terms of our cost of energy now on the rail belt and even commercial energy to the business community. So I really appreciate you being here to catch us up to speed on the project. Do we have any other questions from committee members? Well, thank you, Mr. Thayer. Thank you for coming again to walk us through a little bit more in detail about the Susitna-Wantana project. We appreciate all you do in the AEA. That concludes our business for today. I appreciate the attention of the committee members on this Friday afternoon. We're going to wrap up. Our next meeting will be Monday, April 26th at the normal time, and this meeting is now adjourned at 4:40 p.m.